I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Florida's economy is dependent on growth. It's always been that way. More tourists, more home buyers, more businesses. But now some Florida leaders are considering how to create jobs without recruiting new businesses to the state. Instead, they want to nurture businesses already here. I'll talk with an expert panel about a new concept called economic gardening. Plus, United Arts of Central Florida has a new president. I'll talk with Flora Maria Garcia about what's next for the region's art scene. That's ahead on Intersection. Since the earliest days of Florida, the economy has revolved around growth. Now economic developers are considering a new way to create jobs, keep that growth going, but this time from the inside out. It's called economic gardening, and Florida is one of the first to implement this concept across an entire state. For more about how it works, I'm joined by an expert panel. Fran Korosek oversees day-to-day operations at the Florida Economic Gardening Institute at the University of Central Florida. Fran, great to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And also joining us by phone from Tallahassee is Dale Brill. He's president of the Florida Chamber Foundation and former director of the Florida Office of Tourism, Trade, and Economic Development, which is now part of the State Department of Economic Opportunity. Dale, great to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
So let's talk about this. Economic gardening, a concept pioneered by economists in Colorado who wanted to use it to help grow local companies as a source of jobs and wealth, and economic developers putting a focus on nurturing those companies. Is this a revolutionary concept, Fran?
In the terms of economic development, it is, because in general, economic development, at least in terms of the energy and effort, has been focused on recruiting businesses to move from one part of the country to another part. Economic gardening shifts that focus or places additional emphasis on helping those companies that are already in our backyards, helping them grow locally.
That just sounds like a common sense thing to do. So why is it that states and other municipalities following that other model of bringing in growth from the outside?
Well, I mean, the biggest single issue that I can point to or factor I can point to is that it really is significant when you get a large company to pick up and move to another part of the country. It's job creation almost from day one in significant numbers, where if we work with small businesses like we do at GrowFL and the Economic Gardening Institute, if we help a 20-person company add 2 to 4 people, it's just not going to get those kind of headlines.
Dale Brill, you've been on the side up in Tallahassee looking at this. Is this a new concept up in the halls of Tallahassee, or are people hearing something new?
Well, it depends on how late you are coming to the party. There, again, those folks that were involved in the early days of championing economic gardening as a state initiative are wondering what has taken everyone so long, but welcoming them nonetheless. So we've been working on this, since about 2009?
That's when we first got started.
Yeah, and so, but again, this was formal and feature agenda item of Governor Charlie Crist at the time, who put economic gardening in the special session, brought the legislature back, and this, if I'm not mistaken, was the only agenda item. And fortunately, it has been embraced by the Scott administration because, well, it works.
Well, walk us through it. What do you do that's different from the approach of trying to get companies from the outside to come to the state?
Well, the biggest difference is in how we're working with the businesses that are already here. Again, what we're focused on is something called second stage companies, companies with between 10 and 100 employees, or 10 to 99 employees is the generally accepted definition. And what we do with them is keep in mind, these are companies that are beyond startup, right? So they have a product, they have service, they have customers, they're just not big yet. So what we do is help them grow by helping them grow their sales. So my team with GrowFL at the University of Central Florida is focused on providing market research and business strategy assistance to help a company grow their sales. And if they grow their sales, by definition, they're going to have to hire people to deliver on those sales.
And help us walk through for people that aren't involved with business. We always hear about different types of economic incentives that are given, but you're talking about actual data, not just money.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely correct. One of the ways I characterize what we do to a second with a CEO of a second stage business is that my group is a Fortune 500 company's market research department. We just happen to work at a university, and we happen to put it at the disposal of a second stage company's CEO so that they can ask questions that will affect their sales tomorrow.
Dale Brill, what does this mean on a policy level? Is there something that the legislature had to do to implement this, or is it just a strategy shift?
It's a little of both. When it was first initiated, it was such an about-face turn for the economic development community. And again, the legislature also embraced it and said, let's establish funding for it. It was a whopping $2 million for the program itself, and that was a launch. It was also associated with a kind of a partner program that was a small business loan program that was an $8 million allocation. So the total at the time, those historians that are listening will recall it was a $10 million project, but really it was just $2 million for the true and core aspect of what Fran has described as economic gardening. And so it did take legislative action. It took leadership on the governor's behalf and the leadership of both the House and the Senate. And then once we got into that, then it was, well, let's see what you can do with the concept in the state of Florida. Again, as you mentioned, this is the first time any state had ever tried to do it as a statewide strategy policy or strategy approach. The good news is that when the first reports came back from Fran and his group, as good grief, the evidence demonstrated overwhelmingly that job creation was happening, and now you start doing some math. You look at recruitment, as you indicated earlier, and Fran spoke to a very, that gets the press, that gets the media, but it's also quite expensive. When you look at the cost per job creation, economic gardening benefits the state in a big way, and it does it for a little bit of investment.
Now, talk me through this a little bit more. You say that there have been good results. Can you give me a practical example of that, but also help us understand, 3 years ago, you're putting this in effect at a time when the economy around the country and certainly in the state here has taken a really big downward hit. So is this a policy that is ripe for when economic times are stressed?
Well, I'll let Fran give you some examples of the case studies that demonstrate that success, but I will say that it was very difficult to suggest that we would go for this kind of homegrown, internal-focused approach, and again, this nurturing concept. The concept is aptly named when we talk about it as economic gardening. That is in sharp contrast to a recruitment strategy, which is analogous to hunting. But it was a significant shift, and as you start looking, as those success stories started to come in, despite the Great Recession, and I think when you're about to hear what Fran's going to share with you, that's the most important thing to keep in mind, is that we're not talking about a fly-by-night or faddish kind of economic development approach that somebody just decided, hey, let's give it a shot, and they lucked up into a rising economic time that floated all boats. We're talking about success that took place in the Great Recession.
All right, Fran Korsak, walk us through it. What are some of the examples of success here?
Well, one of the things that we did to measure the outcome of GrowFL and the economic gardening initiatives was to survey the companies that we worked with over the period of time, primarily the first 2 years of the state's funded pilot program. What we found was that on average, the companies that we worked with created 3 to 5 new jobs over the period of time that we were engaged with them. If you translate that out over the number of companies that we worked with during that time frame, it was the creation of roughly 1,400 new jobs in the state of Florida with the businesses that participated in the GrowFL program. It's pretty substantial. If you do the math on the $2 million that Dale talked about, it's a pretty low dollar amount per new job created.
And how long did it take to get all those 1,400 jobs created?
It's roughly over a 2-year period of time, from the fall of 2009 through the fall of 2011.
Which included the startup phase of the entire program, though, Fran, right?
I mean, absolutely.
You weren't ready. Once that $2 million was allocated, it's not like you flicked the switch on and you were ready to roll.
Right. And to qualify, too, it was $3.5 million over the 2-year period that we're talking about over that time frame.
What kind of jobs are we talking about? Are these low wage, mid wage, high wage?
Well, based on the criteria that was put out through the state-funded program. We worked with companies that were within what is known as the qualified target industries within Florida. So that included manufacturing, wholesale trade, professional scientific, technical, which would include companies like software development companies or clean tech firms. So in general, these were jobs created within industries that typically are higher wage jobs.
How does it work when you approach a company? What do you say to them, and how do you sell them on it? Is it a hard push to convince people?
Well, that's an interesting question. The answer is yes. These are very busy people, CEOs of small businesses that are out there selling, they're developing new products and services, they're working with their customers. So getting them to take a breath away from working in their business and start working on their business is a little bit of a challenge, right? So in effect, we have to convince them that the time that we're going to spend with them is going to be of high enough value that it's going to produce a return on their business.
You've got to convince them it's not a risk.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And not only not a risk, but you are trying to peel them, as Fran just said. They might view it as, wait a minute, you're asking me to take the eye off the ball. And actually what you're telling them is the great paradox is, no, we're going to allow you to focus with a laser vision on the ball of your business so that you can expand it.
Well, tell us about the history of this. This concept pioneered actually in Colorado and Littleton. How did it work in a community like that? And then what were the challenges of putting it on what seems to be a much larger macro scale across the entire state?
Well, one of the things that's interesting about Littleton, Colorado, is that economic gardening is a 20-year overnight sensation. Littleton, Colorado, specifically, their economic development head at that time, who has just retired from Littleton, by the way, his name's Chris Gibbons. He's really the founder of this movement. He noticed back 20 years ago that if he shifted a little bit of his emphasis towards existing businesses, that it couldn't help but do good things for the community that he was in. There were a couple of precipitous events that occurred, but the main one being that one of the largest employers in that community decided to lay off a significant portion of their workforce. And that, by definition, pushed Littleton into having to figure out a way to kind of do things differently. And what Mr. Gibbons did over time was evolve the concepts in terms of the things that we do for companies today. He had the time to develop that over time. And what he really found was a combination of business strategy, market research and competitive analysis, search engine optimization, web strategy, social media strategies, evolving that concept up to today's time, and then using something called geographic information systems, which is a way of using mapping to support market research activities. If we provided information in those areas to CEOs to help them focus on how they pursue markets, how they drive sales, that would provide a significant return to those businesses.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. We're talking about a new economic development concept called economic gardening. My guests are Fran Korosek, who is with the Florida Economic Gardening Institute at the University of Central Florida. Joining us by phone from Tallahassee is Dale Brill. He's president of the Florida Chamber Foundation. I'm Mark Simpson. Tell us what you think the best way to create jobs is. You can let us know on Facebook or Twitter or send an email to intersection@WMFE.org. Dale Brill, talk to me a little bit about what was going through the mind of Governor Charlie Crist when this was implemented. Of course, Governor Jeb Bush had worked through a whole bunch of deals during his time in Tallahassee to bring research and development into the state of Florida. Was it a view of Governor Crist that model had run its course?
No, not at all. In fact, it was a logical next step, and that nothing that I say we say, at least so far, I is going to suggest that recruitment is a strategy that should not be pursued to some degree. And of course, there are limitations to its effectiveness and certainly its cost efficiency, just because you can spend indeed a lot of money. It's very, very costly, as we did as a state, to create the embryonic new industrial cluster that is life sciences. And Governor Bush had done that. Governor Crist said, we're going to continue to make investments in life sciences. If you look at that track record, there were several deals, I guess, if you call them, but success stories in recruiting companies because of the success of the Bush administration and bringing in that early set that included, of course, the one that everyone will remember is Scripps. But we now have a life sciences industrial cluster that is not only growing in the area of Palm Beach County, but your listeners right now are in Medical City and Lake Nona, and what is happening in the Orlando area is testament. And it sometimes people don't see that an investment that took place, you know, a couple of counties away spurs this kind of network creation. But again, that, as you suggested, that is the recruitment strategy. Governor Crist said, well, we're going to continue to do that. His record reflects that he did do that. But the pressure as the recession continued to deepen, and it was clear that you know, we did not have the pocketbook, basically, to play the recruitment game. The governor demanded innovation, and so we sharpened our pencils and did a lot of research in what was, again, called OTED, or the Office of Tourism, Trade, and Economic Development, and discovered economic gardening and had a couple of brainstorm sessions and said, this just makes too much sense. Okay, it's never been tried before, but it just might work here. And people took some courageous steps. And, you know, in government, we don't reward innovation and we don't reward risk taking. And we are the first to say, hey, see, it failed and government can't do anything right. But I think this this shows that sometimes you can make the right step if you take a little risk.
Now, what would be the application of the concept of economic gardening in a place like the Space Coast, where we had a major kind of single employer under the shuttle program and you had a kind of a catastrophic drop off in jobs? How would the concept of economic gardening be able to respond when you see a massive decrease in the job force that's out there?
Well, again, boiling economic gardening down to its least common denominator of what we can provide a second stage business is helping that business grow its sales. So we've worked with a number of companies in Brevard County specifically for that. So as highly qualified engineers and scientists were transitioning out of the space program, that they could find homes in other employers in that local community. One example of that is a company called Coastal Steel down in Brevard County in Cocoa that with us working with them and through their hard effort, we're able to secure some new significant new business, multi-million dollars worth of business that allowed them to hire 50 new people in a very short period of time. That is an extreme success story, but one example of some of the help that we've been able to provide.
Dale, tell us, in Tallahassee, Governor Rick Scott has that that campaign promise to create 700,000 jobs in 7 years, so he must be looking at this saying, this could help out.
Absolutely. And again, his both working with the legislature and the leadership in both chambers with the executive office of the governor, it has been funded this year. It is being embraced. And I think it's been clear, and by my observation, everything that can be done to create jobs is in play. And so, again, it's tempting, though. I don't want to overplay this, but it's really tempting, both in politics and, well, just life in general. When you inherit a program, it's just human nature to say, well, that's not associated with my creation. I'm not going to support it. Governor Scott is a businessman who understands that he campaigned on job creation, and he is going to support this project as long as it hits the return on investment expectations that he has. And the great news is that it works.
Well, we are curious to see how does that garden grow. We'll have to check back in with you guys in a little bit and see how things are going. We've been speaking with Fran Korosek. He's with the Florida Economic Gardening Institute at the University of Central Florida. Also joined us by phone, Dale Brill, who is president of the Florida Chamber Foundation. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, Flor Maria Garcia, new president and chief executive officer of United Arts of Central Florida. United Arts of Central Florida has a new president and chief executive officer. Flora Maria Garcia is the new director of the nonprofit organization, and she comes in just as construction is underway on a new downtown performing arts center and, of course, in the middle of an economic downturn that has hurt donations. Garcia is a native of Cuba who grew up in New Jersey and has held arts administrative positions in Atlanta, Houston, Fort Worth, and Missouri. Great to have you in.
Glad to be here.
So United Arts of Central Florida is a collaboration of businesses, governments, schools, foundations, and others aimed at trying to enhance arts throughout the region. Your predecessor, Margo Knight, was serving in that position for a long time, for a decade, and didn't always see eye to eye, though, with other members of the arts community on big issues, for example, the new performing arts center that's being constructed. So As you come in, how do you deal with that legacy, and what's your own vision for United Arts of Central Florida?
I think everybody comes into a new position looking at a clean slate. And for me, having worked in so many other communities, it's an opportunity to really see what's unique here and what are the opportunities and challenges. So I really come with no agenda whatsoever other than to learn about the community and to make good things happen. And one of the things that excited me about this job was that the leadership, which was part of the interview team was like 12 people, and they were representatives from all different sectors, public and private sector, as well as education, and they were all really excited about the Central Florida area. They talked about the collaborative nature of the community and the opportunities, and that everybody wanted to see this area go to the next level. So that was really exciting and invigorating for me. So I see it as an opportunity to bring my expertise to the table and see what we can do moving forward.
What would you say was the status of United Arts of Central Florida when you came on board?
I think Margot did a really good job of for a long time. I mean, she was here for a very long time. And I think one of the terrific things that she accomplished was diversifying the funding portfolio. So the organization gets funding from both public and private sectors. And it's a nice mix. It's not just one source of funding covering all the bases. And so she was able to tap into sources from different cities, different counties, school district. And so it's a nice portfolio that I can build on.
How is that different from other arts groups that you've worked at in the past?
Well, when I was in Houston, 100% of the funding came from a portion of the hotel occupancy tax. And in other places like Missouri, all of the funding came from the general fund, and that was a state agency. And that is the first thing that gets cut when the economy goes into goes down. And so I like the diversified portfolio here, because if one thing goes down, you know, it's not the whole pot that goes down the tubes. It's one component. So I think it gives us it's a more stable opportunity. It's never a good idea to put all of your eggs in one basket.
So one of the biggest items for the arts community is, of course, getting this new Performing Arts Center, which is going to be part of the three venues that downtown Orlando is getting. The other one's the Amway Center, renovations to the Citrus Bowl. So what do you see as the arts, I guess, long-term future in Central Florida because of that Performing Arts Center? Is that a catalyst then for the arts? Do you think is that going to spur growth forward in the artistic realm?
Definitely. I think it's a great opportunity for Central Florida. All great cities need a great performing hall, and Orlando has not had one. And so this is going to bring in new opportunities, new performers, new things for people to enjoy. I think it's going to be very interesting to see the revitalization of downtown as well, with a whole new crowd coming into the city as a result of the Performing Arts Center. So I think the residents of the Central Florida are going to have this incredible venue that's going to bring very diverse and different and unique offerings to the downtown area.
For the first time in a decade, the group failed to meet its own annual fundraising goal this past spring, off by about $400,000, which is a serious chunk of change.
And yeah.
What happened, and what's the current status?
Well, if you remember, there was no CEO for about 9 months. There was no development director for almost a year. I just hired a wonderful new person, Denise Balin, who comes from Washington, D.C., but her family is from Orlando, so she knows the area, and she just started about 2 weeks ago. And we have a new development chair, Scott Bowman, who has chaired the United Way campaign, who comes from Orlando Magic, who has a strong public relations fundraising background. So I think we have a dynamic new team in place that is moving forward in a very aggressive way. We have some amazing ideas of what we want to do with expanding the donor base. So you really had a bad economy, and you had no staff, really, that focused on development. So we can only go up from here.
Mm-hmm. And talk to me, I guess, you know, do you have to have a war plan in effect because you're starting from that minus $400,000 mark?
Yeah, but the good news is we're starting right at the beginning of a new fiscal year. So it gives us a chance to put a development plan in place. And I've got a marketing task force chaired by a Disney marketing strategist whose expertise is market segmentation. And what we want to look at is, who are our donors? What do they look like? And how do we appeal best to them? So what we want to do is broaden the range of donors. We've had a model of trustee donors, which are those that give $100,000 and up. We have an opportunity to look at expanding the donor base beyond the $100,000. So I'm really excited about the opportunity because there's lots of things that we can do that haven't been tried before. And we have some very, very, very professional people working with us to help us.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking with Flora Maria Garcia, the new president and chief executive officer at United Arts of Central Florida. I'm Mark Simpson. Are you an artist, or what do you think about arts in Central Florida? You can tell us online at Facebook or Twitter, or send an email to intersection@WMFE.org. Talk to me about, you know, maybe the possibility of trying to find other sources of funding for United Arts. I know when you were in Houston, you worked with the Convention and Visitors Bureau to secure some of the hotel occupancy tax for cultural funding. Any chance of that happening in our region?
I think absolutely. It's an exploration that needs to take place. In every place I've worked, we've identified some type of public sector funding stream that's been earmarked for arts and culture. In each case, the funding stream has been different and unique and fitting to that place. And so in the Central Florida area, it will have to be a source that makes sense, that is unique to the place, that resonates with our elected officials and voters.
Do you think would that be challenging going forward, just given the high-level debate that was going on between Orange County Mayor Teresa Jacobs and Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer, just trying to get funding moved forward for the rest of the venues? And certainly there's a lot of competition already for those tourism development tax dollars.
Right.
What do you think in terms of finding a unique funding source, or do you think is this something that you might have to put on the back burner for a while, wait for the economy?
I mean, who knows? I think it's always challenging. It's always challenging. It's never a cakewalk. But sometimes if you have a compelling reason, then revenue streams can be found. I mean, the arts have always been about economic development. They are an economic stimulus. And there's a plethora of areas that the arts affect: education, economic development, tourism. It's a singular nonprofit source that actually gives back. The activity gives back to the economy. And so, and certainly Mayor Dyer really sees the value of art and culture as an economic driver. So the challenge will be finding the right source, making a compelling argument, and then securing the source.
Talk to me a little bit about your own interest in art. You have a degree in fine arts from St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana, and specialized in photography, painting. Tell me about your own interests.
I started out as an artist and really realized very quickly that I was a much better administrator than artist and segued. I did an internship at the University of Massachusetts with the Arts Extension Service. I was the visual arts coordinator for an arts festival. That's how I discovered arts administration and realized I really love putting things together, making things work. And that was really the beginning of a shift from being an artist to an arts administrator. It was a good thing.
Do you still do it on your own, though?
No, I don't have time. I really get a great deal of satisfaction by attending cultural events, doing things with artists, supporting artists. It really feels good to work within the cultural community instead of making art, making things happen for the cultural community.
We've been speaking with Flora Maria Garcia, who is the new president of United Arts of Central Florida. It's so great to have you in.
It's great. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Thanks. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.